It's time now for World Watchers International with Mae Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's Mae.
Good evening. This is broadcast number 535. It's March the 7th, 1982. I'm going to run down just some very quick titles of articles that I hope we'll get into later in future broadcasts, but most of the evening I'm going to talk about two or three of some very, very important articles I want to spend most of the time on. One of those articles is Tumble in Tampa, the Wall Street Journal, March 3rd, 1982. The other is The Company They Keep from the Soho News, November 24th, 1981. And the third story is The CIA Goes to War, February the 14th, 1982, The Washington Post. And I will get back some more to Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig. And I'll do some more on Kurt Kerkorian, Caesar's Palace, MGM, the Hollywood mob connections to the assassination teams. But I do want to get on these other articles this evening and go into detail about those particular articles. Just briefly, I will not do details on the death of Belushi, John Belushi. I will do more on that, as I promised I would, on William Holden and some more on Natalie Wood later. I have my opinions on this death. I think it was a murder just the same type as the rock musicians and artists of the left, and I'll do details on why I believe that. There's a play in London, reviewed just this last week. It's about Adolf Hitler. It's called The Portage to San Cristobal of Adolf Hitler. It's about Adolf Hitler wandering in the jungle in Brazil, and a large part of the play is a justification of his genocide and his policies, and he stands up to defend what he did in Germany. It caused a consternation in England. It's considered very, very controversial, and the interesting thing was the location of Hitler in Brazil, because this, of course, many of you know I've alleged, is where he was 2 years ago until he was seen at his birthday party and left Brazil at the time. There's a new book out, Bitter Fruit, The Untold Story of the American Coup in Guatemala by Stephen Schlesinger and Stephen Kinzer, and it goes into the controversy of Allen Dulles, John Foster Dulles, overthrowing Guatemala for the United Fruit Company, and how the headquarters for United Fruit were up in Boston, and the people such as Henry Cabot Lodge giving speeches in the Senate denouncing the Red Menace in Guatemala while he overturned it, while his family had holdings and money in United Fruit. John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State, was making remarks about the Reds in Guatemala and why they had to put in a fascist military regime when they had financial interests, and Undersecretary of State Bedell Smith also went on the board of directors of the fruit company. They had a democracy for the first time in 100 years, and I bring that up because if it sounds familiar, there are good books on Guatemala, and this is exactly what we're doing again in Central America today. The Los Angeles Times has an article, February 19th, 1982. David Murdoch, I've done some broadcasts on David Murdoch, and he teamed up with Arm & Hammer, that's Occidental Petroleum, and the Hooker Canal, the Love Canal. They're now in the meat-producing business together. They have a corporation that they've joined together, and the attorney is going to be Louis Neiser. Robert Haldeman, who works for David Murdoch, I've said was part of the assassination team of Richard Nixon's administration with the Wallace shooting, the Chappaquiddick affair, the dirty tricks that went on. And Louis Neiser, of course, is now representing Mo Dalitz and the organized crime syndicate down La Costa in the suit against Penthouse. And he wrote the introduction to the Warren Report. This group of people from the legal institutions, the law enforcement agencies, organized crime that have been part of the assassination teams are merging now, huge corporations merging together, but they keep the same team members. Paraquat was been approved for U.S. spraying the United States marijuana crop. I did many broadcasts on that when it was sprayed down in Mexico. Jimmy Carter gave $43 million of our taxes to Dow Chemical to put poisoning on the paraquat on marijuana so that the young generation, whoever had it and was smoking it, will maybe 10 or 15 years from now get cancer of the lungs or other chemical diseases. The Dow Chemical is produced by Exxon, Standard Oil, Chase Manhattan, but is a part of the Shell Oil, the Queen Juliana Prince Bernhard operation coming out of the Netherlands. It's going to be used in the United States. The Drug Enforcement Agency that used 2,4-D is going to be spraying this on the marijuana fields. I might have mentioned before that James Brady is suing the Hinckley family for $46 million. I'm glad to see that he's not going to sit back and after having his head blown off and almost dying, and he still has serious problems, they're suing the Hinckley family, as is Mr. Delahanty, who is also damaged at the shootings. Even though Ronald Reagan is playing very nice about the shooting, the murder attempt on his life, because of the high implications of the Hinckley family with the CIA, Ronald Reagan got the message, he's alive, but these other people are suing. There were awards this last week for the George Polk Award for Journalism, for Radio and Journalism, and I was glad to see that for national reporting, Seymour Hersh, Jeff Gerth, and Philip Taubman of the New York Times got their awards for investigating the intelligence agents, Frank Turpel, Edwin Wilson, George Corcola. They've left Corcola out of a lot of their articles, but they did get awards for that reporting, and I think they deserved them, and I think those are the number one story, these fellows in the country for the past 2 years. San Francisco article, March, the first attempt to kill Gaddafi confirmed by the CIA, the United States, and the CIA had evidence there were plans to murder Gaddafi. We said he was coming here to kill our officials, and yet there were complicated plans, and people around him were hurt and shot. The notorious terrorist Carlos, according to the newspaper yesterday, Saturday, March the 6th, surfaces again in Holland. He's out to destabilize Mitterrand and the French, and Gustave D'Estaing is waiting in the wings to become president of France again. Carlos has always worked for Frank Turpel, Edwin Wilson, Samuel Cummings, and the CIA, and they're resurrecting Carlos to destabilize Europe. Henry Kissinger was on the cover of Time, praising Alexander Haig for saving the nation and being so righteous at the time of Watergate, when their agent, James McCord, was leaving scotch tape on the door to make sure that Nixon got out and that Haig had his finger on the White House tapes. They pull this hanky-panky and get the president out of office, put their own people in, which was really a military coup to compound the one in Dallas in 63. And then Henry Kissinger comes out to praise Haig. Vanderbilt Energy can't find a buyer. That's the Hinckley family in Denver. Doesn't mention Vanderbilt Resources. Nobody's coming up with money for the oil and gas company, and the Hinckley family is having trouble selling it. And I'm sure they want to unload it before they're caught with these lawsuits and everything they get is wiped out. Malcolm X's brother says someone steered the three killers to Malcolm X, and he finally, I don't know where he's been all these years, is saying there was a conspiracy to kill his brother, and that was in the Houston Post. Libyan hit squads are still here. William Casey has to say me too, and so the San Francisco Examiner had a story, a ridiculous story, that they're out here trying to kill our public officials. The FALN, the FALN, is set bombing Wall Street. They're letting off bombs. The Puerto Rican nationalist group that was set up by George Corcola, Frank Turpel, and the CIA, because terrorism is the means by which they'll have the people under their control, not knowing where the bombs will fall next, and putting the police squads on the streets. Washington Post letters say Chile aided the Letelier murder figure. This is Michael Townley, who is in jail, and now he's squealing about the real connections of the murdered Orlando Letelier. Joseph Kraft had a long article on the accomplice to Mahatma Jah, who shot the Pope, and the arrest in Hamburg. They admitted there was a conspiracy. This fellow was with Jah. It's called The Shooting of the Pope, a Byzantine Mystery. Another article in the Washington Post, the FBI wonders if the departing agents of the FBI stripped their files on racketeers before they left. And this has to do with the trial in La Costa, an organized crime suing Penthouse Magazine for accusing them of being organized crime. And there were documents numbered and identified in the FBI that to accomplish these syndicates from not being exposed, the documents had been taken. Of course, J. Edgar Hoover was close to Mo Dalitz and to members of organized crime across the country, the gamblers, the syndicates, the entire mob. He always said there was no mob, and J. Edgar Hoover was very close to them. So the offices have been sanitized, and Wells Fargo Bank has been accused of slander. The Hollywood office, the manager of the Hollywood office, Joseph Moffett, is complaining that he was slandered when they said he approved of $3.5 million in loans in Tennessee. There hasn't been a case on this because to open this up would bring up the whole can of worms of the Wells Fargo missing hundreds of millions of dollars. So he's saying they haven't brought it out, so therefore he wants a settlement of money because he was slandered. It's easier to pay him a little money on the slander than to bring out the whole case. And finally, on the brief mention of news, Ted Chiarock has been given a sentence. He's going to jail. He's the man who made the movie The Second Gun, who investigated the Robert Kennedy assassination and was there when Robert Kennedy was murdered. He did a monumental job. Ted went to Europe through in 1979 and 1980 and in 1981. And he went on tickets that people had parlayed and forged. They wrote somebody else's name on. They took like airline tickets from one city to the other that were $21 and wrote them to $210 and then made them like $2,100. And a woman and a man, one person's left town, isn't in L.A. and hasn't been charged. A mystery witness has gone. But Ted accepted these trips to Europe. And the trips, even though he didn't forge the signatures, they were forged. And he used those airline tickets, and he may be going to jail for 9 years. The Los Angeles Police Department has him in jail, and he was convicted of fraud with the airline tickets. And the moral of that is if you're going to do research and point out all the murderous habits of the Los Angeles coroner, the chief of police, the mayor, and all the officials of Los Angeles at the time Robert Kennedy was murdered, if you're going to do that, then you better buy your own ticket to Europe or not go at all, because you can have entrapment, but that doesn't protect you. So Chiarock was convicted. It's very sad, but he's such a flaky guy. He called me when he was first arrested, wanted me to help him. I said, you're so unreliable and flaky that I wouldn't even be able to separate truth from fiction. I can't help you because you're not consistent, and you are with such weird people. He's brought the weirdest people up to my house, and I can't believe the kind of company he keeps and the kind of research he's trying to do. And entrapment is a perfect way to get Ted Chiarock, and there's no way to save him because he can't distinguish the kind of people he's going to associate with, and he fell into that trap. Now, the first article I'm going into, and I hope I have time for all three, is Tumble in Tampa, How a Bank Flourished by Taking Chances, Then Slid to Its Ruin. This has to do with a bank. The lead article in the Wall Street Journal says, Metropolitan Bank and Trust Company of Tampa, Florida, became the victim of glut of bad real estate loans. Boy, this article includes, they said, Boy Scouts, gems, and a jet. The Boy Scouts is money that the leaders of the Boy Scouts put in a bank that collapsed. The gems are $1 million worth of buried diamonds that were in the backyard in Florida. And the jet has to do with the Air Florida crash that I've been talking about for the past 5 or 6 weeks. The missing millions that involved the bank scandal, there's $53 to $100 million missing in Fort Collins, Colorado. Fort Collins, Colorado is the city where Mr. Tafoya, who worked with Edwin Wilson, was convicted of shooting somebody from Libya. And this is a headquarters, Wilson and Turple. Are active in that city, but I don't know if there's links, but there is this connection of Fort Collins that I haven't heard in the news except in the Tafoya trial. And Atlanta, Georgia, there's $51.4 million in loan missing. And, of course, it was in Atlanta where the C-130s, Lockheed planes were made for Gaddafi, and he couldn't get them delivered from there, so Neil Burke went to London, picked up money, and through Air Alaska and other companies, they ended up with Gaddafi anyway. So the airplanes that Gaddafi had ordered were in Atlanta, and Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple's agent Tafoya was in Fort Collins. And out of Fort Collins is missing $53 to $100 million, and out of Atlanta, $51.4 million. Now, the Wall Street Journal says in 1974, in Tampa, Florida, the Metropolitan Bank opened. They started with $10.5 million that day. They did well for the next few years. They changed the title to Metropolitan Bank and Trust. And then February the 12th this year, just 2 weeks after the air crash, or a month after the Air Florida crash, that was January the 13th, the FBI moved in and closed the bank and took everything out and began to investigate them. And the remains of the bank were sold for $18 million. the bank began to disintegrate, and the chief investigator for the bank scandal at the time that they were going into the problems of these missing millions of dollars was a Mr. Williams, who, strangely enough, was on that Air Florida flight when it went down. And those of you that listened to the broadcast that I have on KLRB, back in, it was broadcast number 530, I was talking about this Mr. Williams, Arland Williams, and the newspaper described him as coming from Atlanta, Georgia. He's the fellow who was supposed to have drowned, who was rescuing five other people that he gave the lifeline to, and the coroner said he died from exposure or drowning. But the thing that was strange about this man that I mentioned on the program when I was listing a lot of reasons why I believe there was sabotage or hanky-panky right from the beginning was that the Washington, D.C. police told the paramedic named Gene Windsor, don't cooperate with the news, don't tell or identify this man. Now, how in the world would, the minute the plane crashed, there's 78 killed, and there's only a handful of survivors, but the police are saying that they had instructions, this particular man, not to cooperate or talk with the news media, and don't attempt to identify him by viewing the file photographs shown to them by the news organization. Now, I saved that article. There were many articles on the air crash, but that really got to me. It was January the 20th, 1982, the Washington Post, and the conflict of don't identify this person and this Mr. Williams. Arland D. Williams, a 46-year-old directing bank examiner for the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta, a balding man with a mustache. And the park police in Washington said the man definitely didn't have a beard, and they made up a different description of him and denied who they were looking at. Now, what did the park police know so early? I mean, the plane just left. The man was there, and goodness knows, out of 78 people, and they're all smashed. There weren't, I couldn't figure out why the park police in Washington, D.C., that came swooping in on this particular accident, had any interest at all whether somebody was identified or not. That seemed weird. Now it seems that the man that the park police was arguing about was a very controversial person, because he was the man, according to the Wall Street Journal, who was about to investigate this particular bank and the large amount of money missing. Now, they describe it as the biggest bank failure in the United States since 1976, which gets close to Michael Sindona and the Franklin National Bank for $45 million and the Franklin Trust Bank for, what was it, another $60 or $100 million in New York. And Fred Bartello, a millionaire who built a shopping center, was in charge of this bank. He bought the majority interest in the bank. And a Richard Greco, described as the right-hand man of Edward D. Bartello, the former mayor of Tampa. He was vice president of Super Bowl champion San Francisco 49ers, Richard Greco. He's still chairman of the Metropolitan Bank Corp, and he was involved with this bank. They had a sudden demise where a large amount of money was missing. It had to do with a man named Alan Wolfson, W-O-L-F-S-E-N, who was being investigated by a grand jury because of millions of dollars in loans that he got from this bank, but he never presented any collateral. He would go to the bank, the Metropolitan Bank, and this reminds me of the Wells Fargo stories, the Hollywood branch, the Beverly Hills branch, the Wilshire branch, where they could go with no collateral. Whoever Mr. Alan Wolfson is, he could take millions of dollars, just take them out of this bank, and he didn't have to put up any collateral for it. Alan Wolfson was described in the Wall Street Journal as earlier being involved with fraud convictions, and he got away with different problems with the law, which they listed in the article, and was not ever put in jail. He'd get a fine and a slap on the wrist, and he could be back in business. He was a New Yorker who moved to Florida. He landed in trouble with the law, and then he would, as I say, get out of it. He became the owner of two banks in Tennessee. Now, there's been a lot of scandals about missing money in Tennessee, and it's also a place where the CIA has functioned. Albert Osborne worked with Permandex out of Tennessee. John Inglis Jr. had contacts in Tennessee. There's a Nazi Core, a hard group of Nazis in Tennessee. Memphis, Tennessee is where Martin Luther King was killed, where there's a large group of the Klan, the Nazi Party. There's a lot of money that came out of the Hollywood branch of Wells Fargo, $3.6 million into Tennessee. Tennessee is mentioned in a lot of articles I have with money connections that are unexplained and also espionage connections that have not been linked to the money yet, but it's a lot of what I call floating money. Wilson was the owner of two banks in Tennessee, and he was considered a millionaire. He worked with a man named Donald Regar, R-E-G-A-R, who ran the Metropolitan Bank, and he had associates with that would put up money, and they would invest it. They got tied up with a man named George Wagoneux, W-U-A-G-N-E-U-X, in the Metropolitan Bank. And when George needed money, Wilson would go and say, give it to him. He'd bail him out of the money. And they began to take these tremendous loans of $1.7 million, $2.7 million, these loans. And Wilson borrowed another $5 million. And it goes on and on. The banks were various banks in Atlanta and in Fort Collins began to be drained of millions of dollars. It added up to millions of dollars. Wilson got caught with embezzlement of railroad funds up in New Jersey, of Morristown and Erie Railroad, New Jersey. And he used the money from the railroad funds to buy a Florida St. Petersburg shopping center. He got out of court on that. He paid $450,000 fine, and he got out of that. He put up these loans with no collateral and no reason for Mr. Wagoneux in Florida. But he wasn't convicted, and Wagner went on to Arizona, moved on to Arizona, where he was charged with some labor frauds. They used money for bank stock. Wilson took money he borrowed from the bank to buy stock in the bank, which is illegal under federal laws. In Tampa, he bribed bank officers to get favorable loans, and then he would repay the loan, and he was convicted also, as I say, the embezzlement railroad funds, and he got off of that in 1980. He was in trouble again with illegal contributions to political candidates, and then he got tied up with a group of people where the money really was missing huge amount, as much as $50 million in one area and $10.5 million in another place. And when they totaled it all up, according to the Wall Street Journal, the Fort Collins, Colorado banks, there was $53 to $100 million gone. The investors lost in Fort Collins, Colorado, and Atlanta, Georgia. It came to $51.4 million. Now, the article goes on to say at the end that the bank examiner for the Metropolitan Bank, who was doing the research on this, was spared temporarily the bank by the death of Mr. Williams. Mr. Williams was on Air Florida in Washington, D.C. He was the one believed to be the heroic passenger. He was the examiner for the Metropolitan Bank in Tampa that was going under, that was under criminal investigation, and all the newspapers said he was from Atlanta, Georgia. On Friday, February the 12th, the Atlanta people said that they were out $51.4 million of loans. So tying the missing millions, which I love to follow, and the Air Florida, the witness and the person who was investigating it, he was on that ill-fated plane. Now, just to update a few more controversies on that plane, because I maintain that it was sabotaged. There were several articles this week investigating. One, the San Francisco Examiner, March the 3rd, ill-fated plane has less power than the gauges showed. The pilot was getting 25% less power than he thought because of false instrument readings as he went down the runway. The flight recorders showed that the two engines were working properly, according to the March the 7th article, but it remains uncertain what caused the clogging of the sensors. And I'll go into the clogging of the sensors and airplane sabotage in the next article that I want to get right into. One story said the snow may have been to blame, but they don't understand why the plane was put into reverse thrust. Now, that's identical to the Japanese airplane that went down a week later. New York Times says the conflict emerges in Air Florida crash testimony. The National Transportation Safety Board has contradictory views on the snow and ice accumulated, and captains of other airlines Equally qualified witnesses see different things. Another article, the aircraft began vibrating as soon as it took off. It shook violently. There was something wrong before the plane took off. One of the passengers who survived said, "This isn't right. We are not going to make it." Another article, a San Jose Mercury pilot tells the board he would have aborted the flight. They were convinced they were not getting the correct instrument readings, yet they gave no indication they would stop. And a TWA pilot said that he left there 45 minutes before this plane, and it would have been possible to abort it. They should have. And finally, the controllers were called negligent in ruling on Air Florida that the plane coming behind them could come in. They told them that they had to get off the runway. You remember? And they're not going to be prosecuted for that. But they said there's a plane right behind you. And this one article this week said in the paper that they should have aborted the flight, that they were told by the controller, get out of the way, another plane is coming. Actually, they could have moved off the runway and not taken off. They had every indication something was going wrong, and they went ahead anyway. And that is a scary thing, to know that people could hear something going wrong, and the pilots could hear it. The control tower says, get going, and they went. And, of course, 78 people were killed 1 minute later, and they went right into the river. Now, going in quickly into the Soho News article, because this fits in so many loose ends of things that I've been talking about for a long, long time, and I like those kind of articles. This is called The Company They Keep, and it was in the Soho News, November 24th, 1981, that's out of New York, by Joe Pennington and Stanley Pinsley. In essence, about this article, and it's a long article, and I've outlined it for you, what it's saying is that there's an organization called The Company, and that organization has been involved with stealing military hardware from Navy intelligence in China Lake, California. It's involved in the killing of the drug judge who did harsh sentencing, Judge Wood, in Texas. It's involved with international narcotic, heroin, cocaine, a $55 million a year operation just out of Colombia alone. The company is directly linked to Frank Turpel and Congressman Jen Redd, who was removed because of Abscam. And the company also is simultaneously part of the Central Intelligence Agency. When they stole a China Lake and sent equipment to Gaddafi or other countries, they were under the impression they were doing it for the CIA. And Frank Turpel said that he's worked for the CIA up until the spring of this last year. And the company and the CIA are both the same. And it is the heroin cocaine operation, the drug smuggling, the assassination teams. And this article begins to bring them together, and it brings the Nugan Bank in Australia as the location of Mr. Chagra, who's now in jail in Texas. He was active in the Nugan Bank, which was the CIA heroin cocaine connections and the assassination teams. And it then takes them to the Las Vegas skimming money, which is an area which hasn't yet been linked to Frank Turpel and Edwin Wilson and William Casey, who our CIA director, who is the attorney for Caesar's World, or Frank Sinatra, the Wells Fargo connections. Now, this article is the first article going into Navy intelligence, the Nugan Hand, the drug connection, and bringing in the murder trials in the Southwest in Texas and going to the Vegas skimming money. So it's an important article because it begins to make that net or web very much closer and bring in elements that I try to define week to week and say that they will come together. And now people are coming out with articles that are making the links of these various agents and the way they operate, the way the United States government steals weapons from military bases, sells them for money. The money is parlayed into narcotics and guns in other countries, and then the narcotics are sold here at a tremendous profit, and then more military equipment is sold, and we are giving away military equipment with the approval of the Justice Department and of the CIA. And this is a story how the Justice Department sat on these stories for several years. And in the interim of their sitting on them, many of the people that I've mentioned that have been killed as a consequence of the investigations coming out are named in the article. And that's very important because There's a long list of murders, more than I have time for tonight, but murders related to these scandals as they unfolded. The Justice Department, the CIA, and Washington have known and contributed to this situation for a long, long time. Now private investigators are going into it and making connections on their own, so the Justice Department is forced to move slowly, and many primary witnesses are being killed. We'll take a one-minute break, and I'll go to the article, Hostility Between the Justice Department, the Company, and the CIA.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.